that I have a bad headache and am resting in our carriage. There is no need for her to rush or spoil her evening.
Alistair!
But he was gone, out into the night. Lucy turned back towards the stairs, dispirited. At least Alistair wasn't leaving the Institute, but she would have preferred. She jumped. Standing in a niche among the shadows was Grace, her pale green dress almost luminous in the dimness. She grimaced when she saw Lucy.
"I suppose it looks as if I have been eavesdropping," she said. "I assure you, however, I had no desire to overhear any of that."
Lucy put her fists on her hips.
"Then why were you here?"
"I was already on the steps," said Grace.
"I heard you galumphing down and decided it would be preferable to hide than to engage in conversation." "You were leaving," said Lucy, "weren't you?"
Grace said nothing. She was standing very upright, not leaning against the wall. Lucy recalled something that James had said to her once about Tatiana forcing Grace to walk back and forth in the parlour of Blackthorn Manor with a book balanced on her head to perfect her posture.
"You know," Lucy said, feeling very weary, "you don't have to marry Charles."
Grace rolled her eyes.
"Please don't worry yourself. I am not impatient to be gone because of some excess of hurt feelings. And don't bother telling me James doesn't really want to marry Cordelia. I know that, too."
Lucy froze.
"I would never have said that."
"No," said Grace.
"I suppose you wouldn't."
Lucy blew out an exasperated breath.
"I know you think we have nothing in common," she said, "but I am the only other person in the world who knows about your brother, who knows the secret you're protecting."
Grace went still.
"You saw Jesse in Idris," she said.
"I spoke with him.
I know that he told you not to help him, and I know that you Herondales are honourable."
She practically spat the word.
"If he asked you not to help him, you won't. What use do you imagine I have for yet another person who won't help my family?"
Lucy raised her chin.
"That shows how well you know me, Miss Blackthorn. I have every intention of doing all I can to help Jesse, whether he wants me to or not."
Grace stepped forward, out of the shadows. Her green earbobs danced in the light like the jewelled eyes of cats.
"In that case," she said, "do tell me more."
It did not take Magnus long to find Matthew Fairchild, leaning against the wall near the door to the withdrawing room, his necktie entirely undone. Magnus stood for a moment, looking at him. Matthew was exactly the sort of person Magnus always wanted to help, and later scolded himself roundly for having tried to help. In Magnus's life, there had been 100 Matthew Fairchilds, young men and women as self-destructive as they were beautiful, who, despite all the gifts that had been given to them, seemed to wish for no more than to burn down their own lives. He told himself over and over that the Matthew Fairchilds of this world could not be saved, and yet he could not stop himself from trying. He leaned against the wall next to Matthew. He wondered why Matthew had chosen to stand here, half hidden from the rest of the room by a pillar. He seemed to be staring rather blankly at the dance floor.
"I have always heard," Magnus said, "that it was rude for a gentleman to be a wallflower."
"Then you must also have heard that I am generally considered to be very rude," said Matthew. There was a flask in his right hand, and a ring with the insignia of the Fairchilds sparkled on his finger. Magnus had long observed to himself that a man who brought his own drink to a party where drinks were provided was indeed in a sorry state. But the real question was, he thought, why no one else seemed to notice that Matthew was only standing up because the wall was holding him. Ordinarily, it would not have struck Magnus as particularly strange. Getting tipsy at a party was nothing unusual for a boy of 17. But Matthew had been drunk when they were at Tower Bridge as well, though a less expert eye than Magnus's might never have spotted it. A less expert eye might not spot it now. It wasn't the drinking,
Magnus thought, so much as the fact that Matthew was clearly practiced at pretending he had not been drinking. Magnus said mildly, I had thought that I might be an exception, since you said you admired my waistcoats. Matthew did not answer. He was still looking at the dance floor, though not just at the crowd of dancers themselves, but rather a specific couple, Cordelia Carstairs and James Herondale. Another Carstairs binding themselves to another Herondale. Magnus had been amused when he'd heard about the engagement. He thought he recalled James having muttered about some other girl to him the first time they'd met, but Romeo himself had once thought himself in love with a girl named Rosaline. It was clear from the way James and Cordelia looked at each other that this was a love match. It was also clear why Matthew was standing where he was. From this vantage point, there was a perfect view of James and Cordelia, his dark head bent over her fiery one, their faces close together. Magnus cleared his throat. I see why my waistcoats cannot hold your attention, Fairchild. I've been where you are. Wanting what you can't have will only rip your heart apart. Matthew spoke in a low voice. It would be one thing if James loved her. I would go into the quiet dark like Jem did and never speak of her again. But he doesn't love her. What? Magnus was unpleasantly startled. This is a false marriage, said Matthew. It's only for a year. Magnus tucked the information away as a mystery to be solved. It did not go along with what he knew of the Herondales, father or son. And yet, Magnus said, during that year, they are man and wife. Matthew looked up, his green eyes flashing. And during that year, I will do nothing. What kind of person do you think I am? I think, said Magnus very slowly, that you are a person who is incredibly sad, although I don't know why. And I think that, as an immortal, I can tell you that a great deal can happen in a year. Matthew did not reply. He was watching Cordelia and James. Everyone in the room was. They were dancing close together, and Magnus would have cheerfully bet £1,000 that they were in love. A bet, it seemed, he would have lost. And yet. Oh dear, Magnus thought. I may need to linger in London a bit longer. Perhaps I should send for my cat. It was as if no time had passed since Cordelia's first ball in London, and yet everything had changed. She felt a million miles from the anxious girl who had come to London, desperate to make friends and allies, who had seen in every face a stranger. Now she had friends, a richness of friends. She could see Anna at the entrance to the ballroom, speaking cheerfully to Christopher. There was Thomas, seated with his sister, and Matthew, beside Magnus Bain. And Lucy, her Lucy, who would one day stand with her in the blazing circles of the Parabatai ceremony. Daisy, said James with a smile. It was a real smile, though she could not quite tell if he was happy or sad or something in between. What are you thinking? One thing had not changed. Her heart still beat too fast when she danced with James. I was thinking, she said, it must be strange to you that Belial's realm was destroyed. One dark eyebrow flicked upward, a flourish of ink across a page. What do you mean? It was a place only you could see, she said, that only you could go. Now it is gone. It is like an enemy that you have known a long time. Even if you hated it, it must be strange to think of never seeing it again. No one else has understood that. James was looking at her with a gentle, puzzling tenderness, the mask entirely gone now. He drew her closer to him. We must think of this as an adventure, Daisy. She could feel his heart beat against her own. Think of what as an adventure? Being married, James said fiercely. I know you gave up a great deal for me, and I never want you to regret it. We will live together as the best of friends.
I will help you train for your parabatai ceremony. I will defend and support you always. You need never be lonely. I will always be there.
His lips brushed her cheek. Remember how well we did in the whispering room, James whispered, and she shivered at the feeling of his warm breath against her skin.
We fooled them all.
We fooled them. So it had been as she feared, despite what he had said and perhaps believed at the time. It had been real to her, but not to him. A strange and bitter pleasure.
I suppose, James said, I am saying that I know this is an odd experience, but I hope you can be at least a little happy, Daisy.
His hair was tumbling over his forehead. Cordelia recalled the thousand times she had wanted to push it back from his face. This time she did, reaching up to brush it away from his eyes. She smiled a smile as false as it was bright.
I am, she said, a little bit happy.
The dimple flashed in his cheek.
I'm glad to hear it, he said,
and drew her closer for the next step in the dance.
She remembered the ball, when he had left her on the floor and walked to Grace.
He would not do that now. He was too honourable. She had him, for this year, a year of bitter joy. She would have her father back as well. She would stay in London and be parabatai with Lucy. She had everything she had wanted, and yet none of it the way she had imagined. She thought of what James had said about fairy fruit, that the more you had of it, the more you wanted, and the more you ached when it was gone. And yet, was not knowing what it was like to taste it not also a form of torment? She loved James. She always would. So many people loved without hope of return, without the dream of a touch or a glance from the object of their affection. They pined away in silence and misery, like mortals starving for fairy fruit. What fate was offering her now was a year of such fruit for her table. A year of living with James and loving him might ruin her for any other love, but oh, at least she would blaze up in glory. For a year she would share his life. They would walk together, read together, eat together and live together. They would laugh together. For a year she would stand close to the fire and know what it was like to burn.
Epilogue. Chiswick House, London. Not far from the lights of London, Nephilim guards had escorted Tatiana to Chiswick House, its gates and lanes choked and rendered almost impassable with thorns. Briars clawed sunlight from every window, preventing the guards, who included her brothers, Gabriel and Gideon, from seeing inside as Tatiana gathered her things and reappeared at the front door of the house, a small brown valise in hand. She looked down at them from the top of the stairs. I would like to be allowed to go one more time to the garden, she said. She did not think the hatred she felt for them showed on her face. They did not seem to know it. They never had understood how much they deserved her loathing. To bid goodbye to the memories of my husband and my father. A sort of spasm seemed to cross Gabriel's face. Gideon put a hand on his brother's shoulder. They had never respected their father properly. Never had mourned him after they let Will Herondale and Jem Carstairs murder him. Gideon nodded. Go ahead, he said with a short nod. We will await you here. Herondales, Tatiana thought as she made her way to the Italian gardens. Tainted blood ran in their veins. In her opinion, their name dominated the history books more than it should. There should be far more instances of the name Lightwood and less of the name Herondale. After all, she wouldn't be surprised if Will Herondale's warlock wife wasn't the first time they'd sullied the line with downworlder blood. She had reached the small walled structure in the centre of the garden. The door was unlocked. She cursed Grace silently. Stupid, lazy girl.
and she hurried inside to see if any damage had been done. To her relief, Jessie's coffin was pristine, the wood glowing, the glass untouched by dust. The ancient blackthorn sword that would one day be her son's hung gleaming on the wall. She laid a hand on the surface. There lay her boy, her sleeping prince. He resembled her husband, in her opinion. Rupert had possessed such fine bones, such delicacy and perfection of feature and form. The day he had been torn from this world had been a tragedy. She had stopped every clock in this house and the country manor at the time they had taken his body away, for then her world had ended. Save for Jessie. She lived for Jessie now, and for revenge. "Worry not," said a silken voice. Tatiana knew who had spoken before she glanced up. He was a swirl of dust at first, a handful of glittering sand that reformed into the shape of a beautiful man clothed in grey, with eyes like shards of mirrors. "Grace will look after him," Tatiana said. "She cares for her brother like you care for no one." "I will let no harm come to Jessie," said the Prince of Hell. "What he carries is too precious." Tatiana knew he was not truly there, that Belial could not walk upon the earth save as an illusion of himself. Still, he was bright as broken glass, bright as cities burning. They said Lucifer was the most beautiful angel who had ever lost heaven, but Tatiana did not believe that. There could be no angel more beautiful than Belial, for he was ever changing. He had a thousand shapes. "Why should I believe that?" she demanded. "You let me sicken from that poison, and I could have died. You promised me that only my enemies would be harmed, and look." She threw her arm out in the direction of the courtyard, where Gideon and Gabriel waited for her. "They still live." "I would never have let you die," said Belial. "It was necessary to keep suspicion from falling upon you. What I did in order to save you." Bitterness roughened her voice. "Save me for what? That I may languish in prison while my enemies flourish?" Belial laid his hands on Jessie's coffin. His fingers were long, like a spider's legs. "We have discussed this before, Tatiana. The death of Barbara was my gift to you, but it was only the beginning. What we have in mind for the Herondales and Lightwoods and Carstairs is so much greater and more terrible than simple death." "But your plan to raise James Herondale up in darkness seems to have failed, even after I prepared him for you." For just a moment, Belial's expression lost its composure, and in that space Tatiana seemed able to see down through the abyss into the visible darkness of the pit. "You prepared him," he sneered. "When he came to me in my realm, there was no bracelet on his wrist. He was protected." Tatiana blanched. "That's not possible. It was on his wrist at the meeting today. I saw it." A smirk passed over Belial's face, but vanished quickly. "That was not all. You did not tell me that the Carstairs girl bears one of the blades of Wayland the Smith." He opened his jacket. There on his chest was a wound, a bloody tear in the fabric of his shirt, through which dark red blood seeped. A wound that seemed fresh and unhealed. Though Tatiana knew he was not really here in a solid form, not really bleeding, the sight was still disturbing. One should not be able to wound a prince of hell. She took a step back. I didn't think it important. The girl seems like nothing." "Then you do not understand what Cortana is. As long as she bears that sword and protects James, I will not be able to come near him." Belial snapped his jacket closed. "Those fools believe that since I have been wounded by that blade, I will not be able to return to their world for a century's time. They do not know I have an anchor here, nor do they understand the power of my wrath." He bared his teeth, and each was a sharp, filed point.
They will see my return sooner than they think.
Tatiana knew she should dread the rage of a prince of hell, but there could be no fear when you had already lost everything that mattered. Her lip curled back.
I suppose you will be facing that return alone, as I will be imprisoned in the Adamant Citadel.
She touched Jessie's coffin, a sob rising in her throat.
And my beautiful boy will languish without me. Oh, Tatiana, my dark swan,
Belial murmured. And now he was smiling.
Don't you see this is the culmination of my plan? The Herondales, the Lightwoods, the Enclave, all of them have blocked you from their seats of power. But where does the heart of the Nephilim lie? It lies in their gift from the Angel, the Adamus, the Steeles that draw their runes, the Seraph Blades that protect them.
She looked up at him, realization dawning.
You mean?
No one can break into the Adamant Citadel, he said. But you will be escorted in, my dear. And then you will strike at the clave from its very heart. We will strike together.
With her hand braced upon the coffin of her son, Tatiana began to smile.
Notes on the text. Most of the places in the London of Chain of Gold are real. There was a Devil Tavern on Fleet Street in Chancery, where Samuel Pepys and Dr. Samuel Johnson drank. Though it was demolished in 1787, I like to think it lived on as a downworlder haunt, invisible to mundanes. The poem Cordelia recites when she is dancing in the Hell Ruel is from Sir Richard Francis Burton's The Book of a Thousand Nights and a Night, published in 1885. The Dick Whittington stone is real and located at the foot of Highgate Hill. Leila and Majnun is an epic poem in Persian Farsi, written in 1188 by the poet Nizami Ganjavi. I have used the exonym Persian to refer to the language Cordelia and her family speak throughout, as Cordelia and Alistair did not grow up in Iran, and Persian was the way anyone speaking or thinking in English in 1903 would have thought of the language. I'd also like to take this moment to thank Tomedy's translation and Fariba Kuklan for help with the Persian in this book. The excerpts of Leila and Majnun are taken from James Atkinson's 1836 translation, which is the one most likely for Cordelia to have owned. Fairy Tale of London, a bonus story featuring Will and Tessa. London, March 3rd, 1880. Will Herondale sat in the window of his new bedroom and looked out at a London frozen under a chilly winter sky. Snow dusted the tops of houses, reaching away towards the pale ribbon of the Thames, giving the view the feeling of a fairy tale. Though, at the moment, Will was not feeling very friendly toward fairy tales. He ought to be happy. He knew that much. After all, it was his wedding day. And he had been happy since the moment he'd woken up, even through having Henry, Gabriel and Gideon troop into his room and bother him with advice and jokes while he was getting dressed, all the way up to the end of the ceremony. That was when it had happened. That was why he was sitting on a window seat, staring at a winter-bitten London, instead of downstairs by the fire kissing his wife, his brand new wife, Tessa. Everything had started out perfectly well. It wasn't strictly a shadow hunter wedding because Tessa wasn't strictly a shadow hunter. But Will had decided to wear wedding gear anyway because he was going to be the head of the London Institute and his children would be shadow hunters and Tessa would run the Institute by his side and be part of all of his shadow hunter life and they should begin as they meant to go on, in his opinion. Henry, wielding a steely from his bath chair, helped Will with the runes of love and luck that decorated his hands and arms before Will put his shirt and gear jacket on. Gideon and Gabriel joked about what a terrible bargain Tessa was getting in Will, and how they would happily take his place,
though the Lightwood brothers were both engaged, and Henry was delightedly married with a small and loudly screaming son, Charles Buford, currently taking up much of his parents' time and attention. And Will smiled and laughed, and looked in the mirror to make sure his hair didn't look disgraceful, and he thought of Jem, and his heart ached. It was tradition for shadow hunters to have a sujanace, someone who walked alongside them up the aisle to the marriage ceremony, usually a sibling or a close friend, and if you had a parabatai, the choice of sujanace was made for you. But Will's parabatai was a silent brother now, and silent brothers could not be sujanace. So that place beside Will would remain empty as he walked the floor of the cathedral. Or at least it would look empty to everyone else. To Will, it would be filled with the memory of Jem. Jem's smile, Jem's hand on his arm, Jem's unwavering loyalty. In the mirror, he saw a Will Herondale, 19 years old, in deep blue gear, a nod to Tessa's warlock heritage, with a gold lining. The gear was cut like a frock coat, the cuffs and hems finely woven with a pattern of gold runes. Golden links sparkled at his wrists. His wild black hair had been tamed for the moment. He looked composed and calm, though inside, his soul breathed grief and love. Until this last year, he had never thought that the heart could hold a full measure of sorrow and happiness at the same time, and yet as he mourned Jem and loved Tessa, he felt both in equal parts. He knew she did too, and it was a comfort to the two of them to be together and share what few others had ever felt, for though Will believed profound grief and profound joy could happen at the same time, as equal love did, he could not believe it was common.
"Don't forget the cane, Will," said Henry, snapping Will out of his reverie, and he handed Will the dragon-headed cane that had been Jem's. Will bowed to Henry, his heart full, then made his way downstairs and into the heart of the church. The room had been decorated with banners bearing gold runes of love, marriage, and loyalty. The sun was bright outside, illuminating the path through the pews that led to the altar. It was decorated with heaps of white flowers that had come from Idris. They filled the room with a scent that reminded him of Herondale Manor in the Idris countryside, a great pile of golden stone that he had inherited upon turning 18. His heart lifted at the thought. He and Tessa had visited the manor in the summer of the last year, when Brosalind Forest's trees had draped themselves in greenery and the fields were alive with colour. It had reminded him of his childhood home in Wales. He hoped he and Tessa would spend all summer months there from now on. His heart lifted further as he leaned Jem's cane against the altar and turned to face the room. He had been afraid that the enclave of London, in their prejudice and bigotry, would avoid the wedding. Feelings about the fact that Tessa was half warlock ranged from indifference to outright coldness. But the pews were filled, and he saw beaming faces throughout. Henry beside Charlotte, who had left baby Charles in the care of Bridget, who wore a hat trembling with a mass of flowers, the recently married Baybrooks, the Townsends and Wentworths and Bridgestocks, George Penhallow, who was currently serving as interim head of the Institute, Will's sister, Cecily, sitting by the large gold harp that had been brought down from the music room, Gideon and Gabriel Lightwood together, and even Tatiana Blackthorne, holding the blanket-wrapped bundle of her son, Jesse, and wearing an oddly familiar pink dress. A part of Will wished that his parents could have been here. He had gone to see them several times in secret, since Charlotte had given him permission to use the portal in the crypt to visit his family. But they were very far from the world of shadow hunters now, and had no wish to return to it. He and Tessa would be going to visit them a few days after the wedding, to receive their congratulations and their blessing. Charlotte rose to her feet. She had removed her hat and was wearing the full regalia of the consul she now was, her robe stamped with silver and gold runes, the consul's staff in her hands. She, like Will, moved slowly between the pews and up the steps to the altar.
She took her place behind it and smiled down at Will. To him, she looked just as she had when he'd first arrived at the London Institute, terrified and alone, and she'd taken him in. A single soft note sounded through the room. Will recalled the harp lessons Cecily had had in Wales. His mother had known how to play it too. Will wished, and all his wishes fell away, because the doors at the back of the church opened, and Tessa came in. She had chosen to dress all in gold, defying those who might say she was not a full shadow hunter and was not entitled to the colour. Her dress was silk, with a seamed basque cut close to her body, and a full skirt overlaid with a layer of ivory tulle. Her gloves were silk and delicate, as were the beaded slippers that peeked from the hem of her gown. Her hair had been dressed with small golden flowers of twisted silk. He had never seen anyone or anything so lovely. She walked with her chin up, proudly, her eyes on Will. Those grey eyes. The first time he had ever looked into them, they had struck through and through him with the sharpness of the metal they resembled. Her cheeks were flushed. She held tightly to Sophie's arm as Sophie sedately walked her down the aisle. Will had not been surprised at all when Tessa had chosen Sophie as her sous-genes. He liked Sophie too, but at the moment he could look at nothing but Tessa. She joined him at the altar, Sophie melting away to stand behind her. Will could feel his heart beating out of his chest. Tessa was looking down. He could only see the top of her head and the gold silk flowers among the loops of her hair. He had never thought this would happen. Not really, in the depths of his heart, where the darkest of his fears were hidden. For so long he had accepted that he would never stop loving Tessa, but that love would never come to anything. It would be hidden, perhaps to burn always with the same terrible agony, perhaps to live on as a choking vine slowly destroying his capacity to feel joy. She would be his only in dreams, the memory of having kissed her the only kisses he would ever know. Herondale's loved but once, and he had given his heart to Tessa, but she could not take it. When everything changed, it had been a very slow dawning of joy, a light breaking through the clouds of loss that carried his parabatized name. He would wake up, crying out for Jem, and sometimes Tessa would come from her own room and sit with him, holding his hand until he slept again. Then sometimes she would be the one to grieve, and he the one to comfort her. And then he worried that love could not grow out of such bitter soil. But grow it did, and richer and deeper than before. By the time he asked Tessa to marry him, they had become gold that had been forged in fire. The time since that day, anticipating their wedding, had been a delirium of happiness, a daze of plans and laughter. But Tessa was not looking at him, and for a moment he was assailed by the old doubts. He said in a voice so low he doubted Charlotte or Sophie could hear it, "Tess, Kiriad, Tess, darling." She looked up at that. She was smiling, her eyes dancing. He wondered how he could ever have thought their colour like metal. They were like the clouds that gathered over Cader Idris. She put her hand over her mouth as if she were trying to stop herself laughing out loud. "Oh, Will," she said, "I'm so happy." He reached out to catch at her hands, and Charlotte cleared her throat. Her eyes were brimming over with love and fondness as she gazed down at Tessa and Will. "Let us begin," Charlotte said. The institute went silent. Cecily had stopped strumming the harp. Will stood looking at Tessa as his life opened out before him. "I stand here in two capacities," said Charlotte. "As the consul, it is my duty to join together two of the Nephilim." She stared fiercely into the crowd, daring anyone to disagree with her assessment of Tessa as a shadow hunter. "As a friend of these two, it is a joy to seal their happiness in the covenant of marriage." Will thought for a moment he heard someone laugh. He glanced out into the rows of pews, but saw only friendly faces looking back. Even Gabriel Lightwood making a face at him was more par for the course than hostile.
"Teresa Gray," said Charlotte, "hast thou found the one thy soul loves?"
"I will rise now, and go about the city in the streets, and in the broad ways I will seek him whom my soul loveth. I sought him, but I found him not."
Will knew the words, all shadow hunters did.
Tessa's whole face seemed to glow.
"I have found him," she said, "and I will not let him go."
"William Owen Herondale," Charlotte turned to Will, "hast thou gone among the watchmen, and in the cities of the world? Hast thou found the one thy soul loves?"
Will thought of the many restless nights he had passed, wandering the streets of London, following no particular direction, seeking no particular goal. Perhaps all those nights he had truly been looking for Tessa, without ever knowing she was what he sought.
"I have found her," Will said, "and I will never let her go."
Charlotte smiled. "Now is the time for the exchange of rings." There was a certain murmur of interest among those gathered in the room. Tessa, though her mother had been a shadow hunter, could not wear the angel's runes. The audience had no doubt wondered how they would choose to handle the runes that were traditionally exchanged at a wedding, one on the arm and the other over the heart, with the bride and groom marking each other with steelies. They would be disappointed, Will thought. He and Tessa had decided to manage the placing of runes after the ceremony. The rune over the heart was often done in private, as it was. Sophie stepped forward, holding out a shallow velvet box in which had been placed two rings, both with the Herondale design. Inside each ring had been etched a single image of lightning, a nod to Tessa's stark weather heritage, and six words, "The last dream of my soul." Will didn't care if the quote wouldn't mean anything to other people. It meant everything to him and Tessa. Tessa took the larger ring first and slid it onto Will's finger. He had always worn his family ring, but it felt different now, weighted with new import. She fumbled with her glove, and by the time he was holding her bare hand in his, slipping the Herondale ring onto her left hand, she was bouncing on her toes with impatience. The ring went on. Tessa looked at her hand, and then at Will, her face solemn with joy.
"Teresa Gray Herondale and William Owen Herondale," said Charlotte, "you are now married. Let us rejoice."
A cheer went up from the pews. Cecily began to strum a loud and probably inappropriate marching song on the harp. Will caught Tessa up into his arms. She was a bundle of soft silk, slippery tulle, and warm lips turned up to his for a quick kiss. He breathed in her scent of lavender and wished they could be away from all this, alone in the room that had been set up and furnished for their private use, the room they would occupy as a married couple for the rest of his life. But there was still the lavish banquet dinner to get through. Will tucked Tessa's arm through his and began to lead her down the altar steps. Charlotte had outdone herself decorating the ballroom. Banners of gold silk hung over the windows, doorways, and fireplaces. A single massive table had been set up, running down the middle of the room. It had been covered in a damask cloth, and the plates, dishes, candlesticks, and cutlery were all gold. Tessa's eyes were huge.
"Charlotte shouldn't have spent so much money," she whispered, as she and Will inspected the flower arrangements, bushels of hothouse roses dripping from every available surface in the shades of gold, cream, and pink.
"Hopefully she raided the Clave's treasury," said Will equably, helping himself to a queen's cake. Tessa laughed and pointed at a matched pair of chairs, massive wooden throne-like objects with pointed backs and gilt inlay. After a whispered conversation, Will and Tessa seated themselves regally just as the ballroom doors were opened to the wedding party. There were oohs and ahs as everyone poured in, dressed in their finery. Cecily, in a blue dress that matched her eyes, came dancing over to hug and kiss and congratulate them both. Gabriel trailed behind her, gazing at her like a lovesick deer in the forest. Gideon and Sophie, happily engaged, were off giggling together in a corner, and Charlotte and Henry were fussing over baby Charles, who had colic, and wished everyone to know about it. Cecily clapped her hands as two of the servants Charlotte had hired especially for the wedding approached the table, carrying two tiered cakes.
"Why two?" Tessa whispered in Will's ear.
"One for the wedding guests and one for the bride," he explained. "The one for the guests will be cut up, and everyone will be sent home with a piece for good luck. Yours is meant to be eaten save one piece, which we will save for our 25th anniversary."
"You're pulling my leg, Will Herondale," Tessa said. "No one wants to eat a piece of 25-year-old cake."
"Hopefully you will feel different when we are both ancient and hideous," said Will.
He remembered then, just for a moment, that Tessa would never be ancient or hideous. Only he would age and die. It was an odd, intrusive thought. He looked away quickly and caught the eye of Tatiana Blackthorn, who had taken a seat at the end of the table. She was clutching Jessie to her, her green eyes roving suspiciously around the room. He knew she was only 19 or so, but she looked years older. She gave Will an unfathomable look and glanced away. Will shivered and laid his hand over Tessa's, just as Henry began good-naturedly wrapping his glass with something that looked very like a test tube. It likely was a test tube. Henry had already set up a laboratory in the cellar of the consul's house in Grosvenor Square. "A toast," he began, "to the happy couple." Tessa had threaded her fingers through Will's, but he still felt cold, as if Tatiana's gaze had spilled ice water through his veins. Cecily had gone back to Gabriel, and he could tell by the glint in her eye that she was planning something. As it turned out, all their friends were. After Henry's toast came Charlotte's, then Gideon's and Sophie's, Cecily and Gabriel's. They praised Tessa and gently mocked Will, but it was the kind of mockery born out of love, and Will laughed as much as anyone. Well, anyone save perhaps Jessamine. She was present in ghostly form, and Will could see her rocking from side to side with amusement, her blonde hair drifting in an invisible breeze. As the dinner came to a close, the silences between Will and Tessa drew out more and more. They were not uncomfortable silences, far from it. There was something else, something between them that crackled like firelight. Every time Tessa glanced at Will, her cheeks turned pink and she bit her lip. Will wondered if it would be considered rude if he leaped onto the table and ordered everyone out of the Institute as he urgently needed to have a private conversation with his wife. He decided it would be. Nevertheless, he was tapping his polished shoes against the floor impatiently by the time guests began to come up to Will and Tessa and excuse themselves. "How absolutely delightful," Will said to Lillian Highsmith. "To see you go," he thought. "Oh yes, very wise to leave before the roads are too icy," Tessa said to Martin Wentworth. "We completely understand." "Ah, absolutely," Will began, turning. "And many thanks to you for coming." He broke off abruptly. Tatiana Blackthorn stood directly in front of him. Her face was scoured of all expression, like a pan that had been overcleaned. Her thin hands worked together restlessly. "I have something to say to you," she told him. He saw Cecily looking over at him a bit anxiously. She was holding baby Jessie. Tatiana must have taken a momentary opportunity to foist the child on Cecily while she came to speak to Will. His uneasiness deepened. "Yes," he said. She leaned closer to him. Around her neck hung a gold locket, etched with the thorn pattern of the Blackthorn family. He realized, with a sudden sick dizziness, that her dress was the same gown she'd worn the day her father and husband had died. The stains on it were surely old blood. "Today, Will Herondale," she said, speaking very low and very clearly, almost directly into his ear, will be the happiest day of your life. He could not have said why, but a shiver passed through him. He did not reply to her, nor did she seem to want him to. She only drew back and went over to Cecily, plucking the swaddled child back from her with a satisfied look. As soon as Tatiana had left the ballroom, Cecily hurried over. Tessa, at his side, was in conversation with Charlotte, and Will did not think she'd noticed anything, thank the angel.
"What was that awful Tatiana saying to you?" Cecily demanded.
"She gives me the horrors, Will, she really does.
Only think, when I am married to Gabriel, I will be related to her." "She told me today would be the happiest day of my life," Will said.
He felt as if a cold stone had settled in his stomach.
"Oh," Cecily frowned. "Well, that's not so bad, is it? It's the sort of thing people say at weddings."
"Ceci." Gabriel had appeared at Will's sister's side. "It started to snow. Look." They all looked. Snow in March was unusual, and when it did come, it was usually freezing, spitting sleet. Not the fat white flakes currently falling outside the windows, ready to blanket the dirty city in a cloud of pure silver. Guests were hurrying to depart now, before the roads became impassable. Cecily had gone to hug Tessa and wish her happy. Will rose to his feet as Charlotte approached him, smiling.
"Tell Tessa I have gone up to make sure there is a fire in our rooms," he said mechanically.
He felt as if he were a great distance away from his own body.
"She should not be cold on her wedding night."
Charlotte looked puzzled, but did not try to stop Will as he hurried from the room.
"Today will be the happiest day of your life."
If Tatiana hadn't said that to him, Will thought, would he still be sitting here by the window, staring out at the snow and cold? The city was turning white before his eyes, St. Paul's a ghost before the dichromatic sky. It was as if Tatiana's words were a key that had unlocked something inside him, and all his fears had come pouring out. There had been no family for Tessa at the wedding, and he worried still that the Clave would never truly accept her, that her part warlock status would always prevent them from looking upon her as a suitable shadow hunter. What if they spoke to her cruelly, and he was not there to stop it? What if they made her life a misery, and she grew to resent him for trapping her in the enclave of London? What if they both missed Jem too much to let go of their grief and live? What if he could not make Tessa happy? The thoughts whirled in his mind like snow. He had lit the fire and the room was warm. There was a great four-poster bed in the centre and someone, Charlotte most likely, had put vases of ivory flowers on both nightstands. They filled the air with their perfume. Snow rustled softly against the window panes as the door opened and Tessa put her head into the room. She was all smiles, glowing like a candle.
"What if today is the happiest day of her life? What if every day from this one forward is sadder and more empty?"
Will took a shuddering breath and tried to smile.
"Tess."
"Oh, good, you're decent," she said. "I was half worried you'd be dressed as Sydney Carton just to shock me. Can Sophie come in? She needs to help me with my dress."
Will only nodded. Tessa narrowed her eyes. She knew him better than almost anyone in the world, Will thought. She would see his fears and doubts. What if she thought they were about her? Tessa gestured, and she and Sophie passed through the bedroom and into the dressing room, as Will looked numbly at his hands. Bloody hell. He hadn't had a single fear or second thought leading up to his wedding. He had woken up every morning wondering if it was possible to be so happy, so full of expectation. Then he would want to tell Jem about it, and Jem would not be there. Grief and love twinned like dark and light in his soul. But he had never doubted his love for Tessa. He could hear movement and soft laughter in the dressing room, and then Sophie emerged, winked at Will, and departed, closing the bedroom door firmly behind her. A moment later, Tessa stepped out. She was wrapped in a blue velvet dressing gown that covered her from neck to ankles. Her hair was down, spilling over her shoulders in a riot of soft brown waves. She crossed the room on bare feet and sank down onto the window seat beside him. "Now, Will," she said gently, "tell me what is bothering you, for I know something is." He ached to take her into his arms. If he kissed her, he knew he would forget. Forget Tatiana's words, the holes in his own soul, every fear he harboured. He never lost himself so thoroughly as he did in Tessa's arms. He remembered the night they had spent together in Kader Idris, the feel of her under his body, the unbelievable softness of her skin. How grief and regret had dissolved in that moment, and there had only been a happiness that he had never thought he would know. But memory had come in the morning, and he feared it would now, too. He owed her better than that. He owed her more than trying to find forgetfulness in her kisses. "It is foolishness," he said, "and yet it preys on me. Before she left the ballroom, Tatiana said to me, 'Today will be the happiest day of your life.'" Tessa raised her eyebrows. "So you think she means each successive day after this one will be unhappier?" "I'm sure she does. She hates you, Will. She hates me, too. If she could ruin this day for us, she would gladly do it. It does not mean she has the powers of the evil fairy at the christening of Sleeping Beauty." "I do know that," he said, "but I have worried all this time I would not be able to make you happy, Tessa. Not as Jem could have made you happy." She looked startled. "Will." "I have never blamed you for loving him," he said, watching her face closely. "Everything in his life he has done with honour and purity and strength. And who would not want to be loved like that? Whereas when I love you, I know it is desperate." He almost winced at the word. "You cannot understand, I think, how I love you. Perhaps I have better hidden it than I thought. It is a shattering thing, Tessa. It threatens to break me in pieces, and I am terrified to be so changed." He looked away from her. He could see his own reflection in the darkness of the window, his face very pale beneath the fall of his dark hair. He wondered dully if he would frighten her away. "Will," she said softly. "Will, look at me." He glanced at her. Even in her thick dressing gown, she was adorable and desirable enough to make him feel dizzy. They had done nothing but kiss, and that rarely, since that night in Kader Idris. They had held themselves back, waiting for this night. Tessa pressed a folded bit of paper into Will's hand. "Jem was here tonight," she said. "I did not see him either, any more than you did. He gave a letter to Sophie, though, and she passed it to me. I think you should read it." Will took the letter slowly. How long had it been now since he had seen the familiar loops and lines of his parapetized handwriting? "Will, I know that you must be happy today, because how could you help but be happy? Yet the fear that you would not accept your happiness has kept me pacing the floors of the silent city. You have never believed yourself worthy of love, Will. You who love with all your heart and soul. I fear the results of such doubts, for Tessa does love you, and you must have faith in one another, as I have faith in you. I stopped outside the Institute today to pay my respects. I glanced in through the window and saw you and Tessa sitting by each other. I have never seen you look so happy. I know you will only be happier for each day of your lives together." Wo men shu sheng su si jiao. Jem. Will took a struggling breath and handed the note to Tessa. It was as if Jem had reached through the dark and icy night and taken his hand. The place over his heart where his parabatai rune had been seemed to spark and burn. He remembered suddenly the last time he and Jem had stood in the Institute together, and Will had said Tessa might not want to marry him. Jem had smiled and said,
Well, that part is up to you.
It was still up to him. He wanted to be married to Tessa more than he had ever wanted anything, and he would not let his own fears destroy that. Tessa had set the note aside and was looking at Will, her grey eyes very serious.
Well, she said, that is that then. Who are you going to listen to, Will?
Tatiana or Jem?
He met her gaze with his own. I am going to listen to my own heart, he said, for it brought me to you.
She smiled a luminous smile and then gasped a laugh as he reached for her and pulled her into his lap.
Wait, she said, standing up, which Will did not like at all. They were meant to be getting closer to each other, not farther apart.
She tugged at the sash holding her dressing gown closed. Will sat up straight, his back against the cold window. The blue velvet material slipped from her shoulders, revealing her dressed in a half-transparent peignoir of white lace, held together at the front with a row of blue satin ribbons tied in bows. She was clearly not wearing anything else. The curves and hollows of her body were outlined by the ivory material, skimming her like gossamer. Will understood now why Sophie had winked at him.
Tess, he said hoarsely, and reached out his arms.
She climbed back into them, giggling softly.
Do you like it? She said, nuzzling his ear.
Charlotte took me to the most scandalous place on Bond Street.
I love it, he said, capturing her mouth in a soft kiss. I love you, though I don't want to think about Charlotte in a nightgown.
He let his head fall back against the window glass.
Take my shirt off, Tess.
She blushed and reached for the mother-of-pearl buttons. Everything in Kader Idris had been fast, a blur of heat and contact. This was slow, her fingers trailing over one button to the next slowly, her lips pressing gently against the skin as it was uncovered inch by inch. By the time the shirt drifted to the floor, he wanted nothing more than to pick her up and carry her to the bed. But they were not quite ready yet. Will fumbled his steely out of his pocket and handed it to Tessa, who looked puzzled.
The last wedding runes, he said. I want you to put them on me.
But... He placed his hand over hers and brought the steely to his arm, where he traced the first wedding rune. The steely sparked against his skin, mixing pleasure and pain. Tessa's face was flushed as they moved the steely to the place over his heart, beside the faded scar where his Parabatai rune had once rested.
Set me as a seal upon thine heart, as a seal upon thine arm, he whispered, as they drew the next mark together. For love is strong as death. The coals thereof are coals of fire, which hath the most vehement flame.
Tessa leaned back. She stared at the rune, standing out strong and dark against the skin of Will's chest. She laid her hand over it, and he wondered if she could feel the hammering of his heart.
Many waters cannot quench love, neither can the floods drown it. I will never stop loving you, Will.
His steely tumbled to the carpet. She was still sitting in his lap. He took hold of her hips and leaned up to kiss her. He was utterly lost the moment their mouths touched. He was lost in Tessa, in the desperate need to kiss her harder, hold her tighter, have her closer yet. His hands slipped and slid over the silk and lace of her peignoir, the material bunching under the grip of his hands. As their kissing turned wilder, Will found himself reaching to undo the silk bow at the neck of her peignoir. She gave a little gasp as the material fell away, bearing the tops of her breasts. Her skin was soft and pale as cream. Will could not stop himself from kissing her throat, her collarbones, tracing his lips softly over the gentle slope of her shoulders. She moaned softly and squirmed in his lap, her hands braced against his shoulders, her nails digging in lightly. If he didn't do something quickly, Will realized, they were going to spill themselves onto the carpet and never get back up. With a deep groan in his throat, he slid an arm under Tessa's knees and another around her shoulders. She laughed in delighted surprise as he carried her to the bed. They tumbled among the soft pillows and the down coverlet, reaching for each other. The long starvation of their wait for this moment finally ended. Will kicked off his shoes, dispatching with the remainder of the peignoir's satin bows as Tessa stretched over him, her long hair forming a curtain about the two of them. In the cave it had been dark. Now he could see all of Tessa, and she was exquisite. She touched his face with wandering fingers, then let her hand trail further down his body, exploring the softness and hardness of his chest, the new rune over his heart. "My beautiful Will," she said, her voice husky with desire. He drew Tessa down against him, and they rolled together across the bed, skin against skin. Kneeling, he began to kiss every inch of her body. As he had known he would, he forgot everything else as she arched and trembled under his touch. There was only this moment, only this night, only the two of them, only Will and Tessa Herondale, and the beginning of their life together. Many hours later, Will was woken by Tessa's gentle touch on his shoulder. He was sleeping with his arm around her, her hair fanned out across his chest. He glanced down at his wife. She was smiling at him. "What is it?" he whispered, brushing a lock of hair away from her eyes. "Do you hear the bells?" she asked. Will nodded. In the distance, the bells of St. Paul's were chiming 1 in the morning. "It is the day after our wedding," Tessa said. "Are you not happier than you were yesterday?" "For I am. I think I will be happier every day of our lives." Will knew a grin was spreading over his face. "You are shameless, my wife. Did you really wake me in the middle of the night just to make a point?" Tessa rolled against him under the blankets. He felt her light touch against his skin. "Maybe not just to make a point, my love." He laughed softly and drew her into his arms.
Chain of Gold, Last Hours, Book 1, was written by Cassandra Clare and read by Fenty Williams. It was recorded by Dominic Fileroots in Soho Sonic Studios in London. Editing by Christina Pichano, Travis Tun, and Michael Bognar. Post-production by Hudson Sound. The associate producer was Claire Tadakoro. Chain of Gold, Last Hours, Book 1, was produced and directed by Karen Perlman. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Chain of Gold, Last Hours, Book 1, is available in print from Margaret K. McElderry Books. Also by Cassandra Clare from Simon & Schuster Audio, Clockwork Angel, The Infernal Devices, Book 1, read by Jennifer Ely.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.